Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. We've got Game 5 Lakers Rockets tomorrow. We got a lot to talk about on today's show. We'll talk a little bit about Game 3, Game 4, what's been going on in this series since we had our last show. We'll talk about the offensive struggles of the Lakers in Game 4, what adjustments they can make in Game 5. And of course, we'll be taking questions and comments from those of you that are joining us here live right now. Speaking of which, those of you who are here live right now, if you haven't done so yet, double check. Just check and see if you're subscribed to the channel. If you're not, hit that subscribe button. Turn on those notifications as well. He's Jovan Buha, Jason Temp there in the middle, and I am Trevor Lane. Guys, happy to be back for another show here.
What's up, guys? It's good to see you. I think we all were hoping for a split in Houston. I think that would have been the favorable outcome. I think there was always that possibility that Houston would go home and tie the series. I don't think, like, the idea of them just going up 3-0 on these dudes before the series was just beyond comprehension. I just am so impressed by where we're at this point, given the dynamics of the series coming in.
We have a lot to talk about because we witnessed one of the great playoff collapses of all time. Houston up by 6 with less than 30 seconds left. And not only blows the 6-point lead, but blows the 6-point lead in 12 seconds. Might be the worst 12 seconds of basketball any NBA team has ever played. It was just remarkable how bad that was. But the Lakers found a way to, you know, did not have their best second half, forced the OT, and then ended up out executing Houston and taking the 3-0 lead. And then Game 4 was rough, but with the quick turnaround, LA now is a couple day break. I think things should look better in Game 5.
I guess let's start there with that game. Because Game 3 was so fun, the way that all played out. I mean, I even did on the live play-by-play. I said, well, the Rockets are taking Game 3. And I mean, everybody thought it was over. There were so many people who turned off that game thinking that it was done. And then somehow, some way, the Lakers come back. How much of that, Jason, how much of Game 3 was the Rockets making every mistake you could possibly make seemingly in that situation? How much of it is, man, you give the Lakers a lot of credit for keeping their heads in it and finding a way to tie that thing up?
Yeah, I think the main piece of credit I would give is to Marcus Smart, frankly, because I think even the Lakers had given up on the game. I mean, like LeBron James is one of the greatest winners in the history of the sport, if not the greatest winner in the history of the sport. And that dude, like, gave up on the Luke Kennard missed three. And after that, he had one last drive and he turned it over. And then he started jogging back on defense while Alper and Şengün got a layup. Like, they had essentially packed it in. And then Marcus Smart made one play, the steal and drawing the foul that kind of breathed life back into the team. And from there, LeBron reengaged and LeBron makes that incredible steal. The steal was every bit as impressive as the shot itself, as he was chasing around a much smaller, quicker player and managed to get the basketball with one of those classic kind of reach from behind steals. But, you know, that's the story of the series. Like, I don't think the dynamics were wrong in terms of what we talked about before the series and the Lakers having a ball handling deficit, the Rockets being the more athletic team, the Rockets being the better defensive team in terms of just the amount of defensive talent that they had, the Rockets coming into the series having a better net rating with KD off the floor than you would think, and them kind of coming into the series as a real proposition for the Lakers to try to overcome. But how the Lakers have won has been kind of through just being the smarter team. They've won through game planning. We talked about that before the series, the idea that JJ would have a game planning advantage in the early phase of the series. They've won through the Lakers have made a ton of mistakes, to be clear. Like, they have a million turnovers in this series. They literally have the highest turnover rate out of any team in the postseason. But, like, in the key moments of games, they've been able to take care of the basketball, execute, get good looks, and handle their business. Like, The difference in this series is in the key moments they've made fewer mistakes. Whether it was the tail end of game two when they were double teaming Kevin Durant and the team made mistake after mistake after mistake while the Lakers did not on the other end of the floor, or whether it was game three at the tail end, and that was another game where the Lakers made a lot of mistakes in game three. I think they had 39 turnovers and offensive rebounds allowed. But they just, at the end of the game, made fewer mistakes. To their credit, after the six-point deficit was blown, in overtime, they were the better execution team. Like, they just, in all of the pivotal moments of the series, they have been the better execution team because they're smarter, older, you know, a veteran type of team. We like to pretend that these series are kind of determined by what we see in the final series score, and they are, but they're usually a lot more complicated than it looks on the surface. Like, for instance, the Orlando Magic are up 3-1 on the Detroit Pistons, but it's like game three comes down to Franz Wagner hitting a contested pull-up two and then like a bomb contested catch and shoot three off the left wing. Like, he misses those shots, which he usually does. The Pistons go up 2-1 in the series. Yesterday, literally, Desmond Bane banks in a pull-up three at the top of the key. Tobias Harris misses a wide-open three. Danish Jenkins misses a wide-open three. Like, that very easily could have gone the other way. And, like, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the scoreboard is the scoreboard with the series. And the Lakers are up 3-1 because they've just made the key plays in the key spots of the series. And that's what kind of makes Wednesday night so fascinating, is the Houston Rockets still present real challenges, and the Lakers are going to have to make the key plays in the key phases of that game in order for them to close this thing out.
Yeah. I mean, this is a game five that we're going to go into where the Lakers have to go back to. We saw them make tons of mistakes in game four. For game five, they're going to have to go back to being the team that makes fewer mistakes. And I do think one of the things that we saw in game three, where the Houston Rockets just make mistake after mistake, and the Lakers were able to capitalize on that and really take advantage of that. But the Rockets did find ways to get stops late in that game. And so now we've got a Rockets team that has had some success against the Lakers for the last, you know, six quarters or so in terms of getting the Lakers to cough the ball up, turn the ball over. That's my biggest concern here moving forward, is that they've got 43 turnovers in their last two games combined, which is just an absurd number. They set the season high for turnovers in game four. They've got to clean up that side, and that's where the Lakers, where I need to see the experience factor of the Lakers really come through as they go into this game five. That said, I also think that Houston gave the Lakers all the motivation in the world with the way they reacted after game four. Their antics, the behavior we saw from the Houston Rockets gave the Lakers all the motivation in the world to be extra fired up for game five. And I do think they're going to look particularly sharp coming out for that one. But game three was amazing. It was a great comeback win. And I was pleasantly surprised that they were able to pull that off. That wound up, I mean, what, it's only happened one other time in the last 1,700 some odd games where that scenario has played out. And I was thinking about it. Most of the situations that have come down to that, we've probably seen the team that is down just concede. Just concede the win to the other side when you're down six with 29 seconds to play and you don't have the basketball.
That's Marcus Smart for you.
Yeah, right. To find some way to get that win. Absolutely incredible. Some of that too, of course, was huge. Like, what was Jayson Tate doing? Just diving into,
oh my God.
Why did Jabari Smith pick up his dribble? Like, I will never understand why Jabari, and they have four Rockets players in the backcourt, and he passes to the two guys who have Marcus Smart in their vicinity. If he randomly picked up his dribble because he didn't trust his handle and he was like, I need to give the ball to a better ball handler, Tari Eason was right to the right of him. So I will never understand why Jabari Smith picked up his dribble there. And yeah, I mean, it was just but to your point about the record, I calculated it. I went and they had a 0.0005% chance to pull off that comeback based on the track record in that scenario. So not even close to 1%. Like I had said on my show after the game, I was like, 99 out of 100 times, the team that's up six with the ball wins with 30 seconds left. No, that was far too generous. It was 0.0005.
Why was Jayson Tate even in the game?
Rockets Twitter crashed out about that. Rockets fans were not happy about that.
Why was he in the game? Why? There were so many things the Rockets did. Why did Jabari Smith screen Alperen Sengun for LeBron James on the final, came flying in and took out Sengun and allowed LeBron to go ahead and get that three uncontested. Why did Alperen Sengun
keep going
in the game? The game winner. throw it off the side of the backboard, and they didn't even run the play their coach drew up. My God.
Before the series, we talked about the coaching advantage for JJ, and I think that is really the thing that we even more grossly undercounted for. Because if you really think about it, because like everyone says, like, oh, like I saw Rockets fans, like, we should be 2-2 right now. And that's just not how it works. The Lakers end up losing game three, then they come out for game four with a different level of focus and intensity. Like, you just can't fake urgency. Like, just ask the Denver Nuggets and Timberwolves after last night. Like, it literally suddenly they were the team bullying Minnesota out of nowhere when they've been getting their butt kicked all series. Like, you can't fake urgency. But we definitely underestimated that, because I think we all can agree now that we greatly underestimated the Lakers' chances to win the series before, obviously. But this series, even under the circumstances, it should have gone seven. And the reason it's not is because it's been so dramatically bad. And as Jovan said, you have this all-time great playoff collapse in there, all-time bad playoff collapse in there that exacerbates the problem.
Or great for the Lakers, yeah.
Yeah, or great for the Lakers, yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is, like, I listen to a lot of preview pods, just national pods, Lakers pods, whatever, going into the series, just hearing other people's perspectives. And everyone unanimously was like, there's probably going to be one game that the Rockets just decombust in crunch time. I don't think anybody saw that coming to that extent, right? Like, and already in like games one and two, it was relatively close that went into the clutch, and LA just out executed them and kept them at bay. So, I mean, you can maybe even say like they already had lost a couple of clutch games to LA, but this was at like a different level. That the only thing that comes close to me was that Clippers collapse against OKC in 2014, but that was a more extended collapse. I think it was like 50 seconds, 48 seconds, something like that. It was also Chris Paul at the helm. So you did not expect that compared to maybe some of Houston's guys, but that's the only thing I can remember coming anything close to this, because this was just the most insane thing I've ever seen.
This is a Rockets team that we thought, you know, what, at the beginning of the season, well, Kevin Durant is going to come in and that's going to change a lot of their half court fortunes. And that's not been the case. Kevin Durant, first of all, hasn't been available for most of this series. The report out of today is that he's walking on the anti-gravity treadmill. That doesn't sound like a dude who's playing tomorrow. I know the Rockets
came out and said he expects him not to play, right? I think I saw that this morning. Is that true?
Yeah, the expectation is that he's not going to play. But where do we go from looking at what happened in game four, the Rockets? I mean, this is, I said going into the series, the Lakers, the goal is to keep these games close and then win in the deep waters where the Rockets really struggle in the fourth quarter. The Rockets blew out the Lakers in game four. There's a lot that went into that. There's certainly a conversation about fatigue and there only being one day off, which actually bleeds into a conversation about game six and game seven, because if those exist, because there's only one day off between those games, between game five and game six, and between game six and game seven. But there's a fatigue factor there for game four. But we also saw a little bit of a shift from the Rockets as well. This was the one game of the series that they did not beat the Lakers in terms of offensive rebound percentage, and instead focused more on forcing turnovers, and they did a great job at that. Is there anything from game four that you look at and say, well, this is a concern now going into game five, in terms of how the Houston Rockets can give the Lakers problems? Or is game four just kind of a, hey, they were fatigued, that was that, it was one game, and the Lakers are going to go take care of business in game five? Jason, how do you see what game four means for this upcoming game tomorrow?
So I literally think 90% of it was the fatigue and urgency factor. I thought that the Lakers took that early 10-4 lead, and I think that had they pushed that to 10 at some point in the first quarter, I think they probably would have locked in and gotten the job done. But Marcus and LeBron in particular just didn't have it. You could tell they didn't have their legs, and they both were both very mentally fatigued as well and had some sloppy turnovers. And each of them had some pick six style turnovers early that immediately evaporated the lead. And then, like, that was when I could tell, like, oh, they don't have it tonight. Like, you could tell, like, pretty much in the late first quarter, you're like, okay, like, the Lakers are probably not going to win this game. The two things that I would say is, one, the offensive rebound, the lack of crashing didn't actually manifest in any change in the Lakers' transition offense. The Lakers had, according to Synergy, 20 points in transition, which tied their series high. So it wasn't so much about that. What you saw less of was there were sequences where, like, Houston would jailbreak to the glass in the first three games, and the Lakers would secure a rebound and throw a quick kick ahead pass to, like, you know, somebody that was just across half court. And then they would, like, hold it and wait, and everyone would run up, and then they'd run half court offense. And so there were a lot of possessions where Houston failed to get an offensive rebound, and it led to the Lakers not having to face ball pressure. Whereas in this game, I thought the lack of crashing kind of manifested in, like, an earlier pickup point more consistently, so that they just had to face more ball pressure on the just the general amounts of possessions they were bringing the ball up the floor. That said, I still think the turnovers in this series for the Lakers have mostly come down to just mental focus and fatigue. They do a really good job for a few minutes, and then they let it slip for a few minutes. And in those few minutes, they'll have like 3-4 turnovers in like 6 possessions. And that they've done that in the late second quarter of like every single game, for example. So I really think it's like, even though that was an adjustment for Houston that I do think increases their chances in terms of causing problems with the turnovers, I think the Lakers can manage that in game 5 if they just focus. The only other thing I would add is Alperen Şengün has appeared to realize that he can just go through Jackson and DeAndre's chest. And some of it's frustrating from an officiating perspective. Like, in the interest of just being self-aware here, Austin and Luka are two of the most egregious floppers in the league.
100%.
But we need to add Alperen Şengün to that list, because that dude is on the floor constantly. And what is incredibly frustrating is he gets to just drop his shoulder and lead with his off arm like a battering ram over and over again. And if anybody hits him back, it's a foul. And that's extremely frustrating. I do think that the Lakers are going to kind of manipulate that a little bit with the gamesmanship with the refs in this game and be like, hey, listen, he can hit us, but let us hit him back. But I do think that Alperen Şengün has a chance to go in and kind of dominate game 5 the way that he did game 4. And I think it's going to be on Jackson and DeAndre to really try to flip that dynamic. That's the one real thing. The only other kind of like side thing I'd say is like Reed Shepherd is the one guy where it's like, we kind of have to give him some of these pull-up threes. And if he makes them, there's not really a whole lot we can do about it. So like he's kind of there. I think the Rockets certainly can go in and win game 5. But if the Lakers execute to take care of the basketball, they bring the requisite energy. And like, I thought our defense was by far the worst of the series by like a wide margin. Like we just didn't compete really in any of the phases that we typically competed in earlier games. So they flip that script. They take care of the basketball. I expect the Lakers to take care of business. I don't think the Houston adjustments really were more than just the urgency dynamic.
I do agree with basically everything you said there. Let's go to Jovan to get his take on game 4 and what it's going to mean going into game 5 in just a moment. First, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, and that is Prize Picks. Let's take a look at this here. Prize Picks, use the code HMA, play $5, get $50 instantly. Link is in the description down below. Looking at some of the plays for tonight. Super simple. All you got to do is pick more or less on some of your favorite players. Guys, if you see anything that's standing out to you, let me know. I've been looking at Tyrese Maxey, 17 and a half points.
That, you got that's very low.
I like that. I do like that.
Anything I like Steph Castle threes. He has made 7 catch and shoot threes in the series through 4 games, which is averaging more than 1.5. And he's been left wide open over and over again. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that he makes 2.
Easy peasy. Let's go with that. $10 entry fee, win you $21. We got a demon and a goblin in this play here. You guys can check that out. Use that code HMA to play $5 and get $50 instantly. And if you do play, please do so responsibly. Big shout out to Prize Picks for sponsoring today's show. Guys, all right. Jovan, your thoughts. Game 4 leading into game 5. What do we take away?
So I do think we're selling Ime Udoka and the Rockets a little short here. And look, I've been critical of them for most of the series. I have said multiple times that the Lakers are playing chess while the Rockets are playing checkers. But I do think it took him far too long to get to some of these conclusions. But like, for example, it took 2 games to realize Tari Eason is a much better player than Josh Okogie, even if Tari Eason is not making his threes. Like, he's a better rebounder. He's more physical. He's more athletic. He can attack off the dribble against the closeout, you know, compared to Josh Okogie. Like, Josh Okogie is a glaring net negative. And then defensively, I think he's actually done a good job against Luke Kennard over the last couple of games, top locking him and not letting him get open. But he's more of a bench player that you play like 15 to 20 minutes, whereas Tari Eason should be playing at least like 30 to 50% more than him. So I think that there's been some little things of also leaning more into Reed. Like I wonder if game two looks different at all, if Reed Shepard just doesn't play 11 minutes. Like I will not understand why they ever did that. But I think Houston has ramped up the physicality, and the longer this series goes, like I think it is imperative for LA to close this thing out in five, because you get to six. Now you're back in Houston. They have momentum of, we won the last two, we really blew game three, and all of a sudden they're playing with all this confidence and momentum. And then it also shifts to the one day in between five and six, one day in between six and seven. And that to me favors the younger, more athletic and physical team. But I think Houston's ball pressure, to Jason's point, I agree that the not attacking the offensive glass didn't necessarily prevent LA from getting out in transition, because Houston also has their own turnover problems that lead to transition opportunities for LA. But it did allow their defense to get set more consistently. And I think just to a man with the Houston defense, they've just been mauling the Lakers and getting away with it. And they've been dictating the terms of engagement in a way that, for those of us who picked the Rockets to win the series, like this is how I thought a lot of the series would look like game four. And that's just not how the series has played out. But it feels like Houston finally realized, like, oh yeah, we have physical advantages at almost every position here. Let's actually leverage that. And they've also, I think, done some smart things with Marcus and like they've kind of, I think, scouted Marcus to kind of play him more for the pass. Like they know when certain situations Marcus is looking more to shoot, certain situations Marcus is looking more to pass. With Luke, they've just been grabbing Luke, top locking him and not letting Luke get open. And you saw a lot of the looks that Luke had the first couple games haven't been there the last couple games. Then LeBron, LeBron has had 2 8 turnover games in this series. I think they've realized that for as great as LeBron is, and he still clearly can be a high level number one option, the Lakers have tried to scale down his primary ball handling, and they don't often have him dribbling up the floor. They often have Marcus or Luke or someone else trying to initiate to get the ball to LeBron, then running an action out of that. But we've seen when he's had the ball a certain amount, he's also struggled with his handle and taking care of the ball. They've had a lot of on-ball turnovers with him specifically, of just like poking at his dribble, ball pressuring him. So I think it's too little too late for Houston, and I still think the Lakers will win this in five. But I do want to give Houston credit for doing some of the things that they should have been doing going into game one. It just took them until the middle of game three to do it. But I will say, like, LA's in an extended rut right now offensively. 134 points over the past six quarters. That's 22.3 points per quarter, 89 points per game. Their offense has been in the mud. And as Jason has pointed out with the fatigue, it's like, I they should be better coming off a couple days of rest, but the longer the series goes, like, naturally Houston just has more momentum. But I also think there's a fatigue element of the Lakers are like leaning so much on their starters, and they had three guys averaging 41 or more minutes going into game four. I don't know if you could sustain that for a full 7-game series, then have a quick turnaround going into the OKC series. So they have to close this out, I think, in five. Otherwise, it might be going seven. And then at that point, like, you just, at that point, if you've lost three in a row, like, who knows? So I think that they got to be careful here, but I do think we'll see a better effort in game five for sure.
I think we're definitely going to get a very locked in Lakers team for game five. I think they understand what's at stake in this one. This is the first game, by the way, that they are the favorite to win. Games one through four, they've been the underdog in some games.
Only took four games.
Right. Only took four games. But now they are actually the favorite, and it actually jumped quite a bit. They were a 2.5-point favorite last night, jumped to 4.5 points today. We got to talk, obviously, about the pending return of Austin Reeves. But to your point about the Lakers offense, their offensive rating, 104.5 right now over the last two games. They had a 117 offensive rating during the regular season. So that's a big, big drop. And they are the worst turnover percentage team of the playoffs. And obviously those two things can go hand in hand. But a part of what we're seeing the Rockets do too, especially in game four, was we were seeing a lot of, if the Lakers didn't just outright turn it over, which I believe the Rockets had want to say 17 steals, so 17 live ball turnovers for the Lakers in game four. So they're not just forcing turnovers, they're forcing live ball turnovers. But even when they don't force turnovers, they were, by getting back more, they were forcing the Lakers to spend more time before they got into their offensive set. And then they would blow up the first thing the Lakers were looking to do, sometimes the second thing, and then suddenly you're up against it in the 24-second clock, and then you wound up taking very difficult looks. So for the Lakers, some of that can certainly be fatigue, and there can be more crispness to the offense just when they have fresher legs to play on, which they should with 2 days off here. And again, the addition of hopefully Austin Reaves, sounds pretty certain that he's going to play in game five, but that's going to be something to watch for heading into this fifth game. It's, can the Rockets continue to get the Lakers to be delaying getting into their offense? Can they slow that down a little bit? And then you're settling for tough shots. The Rockets, they're not a good half-court offense. Game four, they avoided having to play half-court offense by turning the Lakers over and getting the Lakers to take bad shots and then being able to run off of misses. So can the Rockets avoid playing that half-court offense by getting stops on the Lakers? And can the Lakers go the other way and say, you know what? Our offense is going to be so efficient, you're going to be taking the ball out of the basket, which is more what we saw in game one. Game two fell apart the second half of game three, as Jovan was just referencing. So that's going to be a key battle, I think, to keep an eye on in this one. But let's talk. You know, Shams had the report today that there is optimism. It reminded me of Woj during the draft. Remember Woj tweets during the draft where he'd say, X team is laser focused on drafting player Y. That was Shams. Austin Reaves is optimistic that he's going to play basically everything except he's back. Assuming Austin Reaves does play in game five, Jason, how will that change things for the Lakers?
For starters, I think that the Lakers have managed this really well. What I mean by that is, like, the way that Austin was listed as questionable, what that tells me is Austin probably could have played if he needed to in game three or game four. And I think the Lakers going, we have a mix here that's working. We've won twice. Okay, now we've won three times. Let's keep this group together. Let's not mess with Marcus's usage. Let's not mess with Luke's usage. Let's kind of ride this out. Like, let's wait with Austin. I thought that all made a lot of sense. And I think that, like, for instance, had the Lakers lost game three, I think we would have seen Austin in game four. And now I actually do think, to all the points that Jovan made, like, this has been a matchup where the Lakers have won despite some clear disadvantages that have manifested at large stretches of the series, right? What Austin specifically brings that I think is super important is, one, ball handling, just to get the ball up the floor, which is just a very simple thing. But two, the best offense that the Lakers have been able to get in this series most consistently has been attacking Şengün and pick and roll. And getting a guy that, like, you've seen it with Marcus. Like Marcus has been able to make plays here or there, but it's hard for him to sustain. His best attacks have actually been, like, one-on-ones against Reed Shepard. But, like, Luke has started, as Jovan pointed out, has started to get under control by Houston's defense. Having a guy, like, I would argue, like, Austin is one of the best possible types of guys in the league to attack a guy like Şengün, and even in poor rhythm. And there's all these trickle-down effects too. Like, let's say he starts drawing the Amen Thompson assignment. That all of a sudden kind of configures the floor in a way where if Houston wants to play Reed Shepard, now maybe Reed Shepard ends up on a guy like Luke Kennard, and you get a better matchup for Luke to attack, because now you can't put an Amen Thompson on a Luke Kennard, or you can't put a Josh Okogie on Luke Kennard because he has to guard Austin, right? So, like, I think putting Austin out there now makes a lot of sense. Marcus and Luke just had their worst game of the series. The Rockets are going to be their most confident form of themselves. The best form of offense the Rockets have been able to generate has come through Amen Thompson attacking in the post. Let's put one of our best pick and roll players, and arguably one of the best pick and roll players in the league, out there and let him cook a little bit. Now, I think that also them being at home and having the rotation set the way that they did will allow them to kind of manage Austin's minutes in a way where he can play in short bursts, so conditioning isn't as big of a deal. I just think it's like the ideal circumstance to bring him back. Not to mention it's a perfect little dip your toe in the water thing if the Lakers do win for prep for the next round. Like, get a couple reps against Amen Thompson, you won't be as freaked out by Cason Wallace. You know what I mean? So I think they played this really well. I think it's the perfect time to bring him back. I think it's a good matchup because of the fact that Şengün's going to be running drop coverage against him. I just think this is kind of setting up really nicely for Austin's return.
Jovan, your thoughts on Austin, his ability to come back and be a factor. I'm looking at this from the perspective of, can Austin, at the very least, when we're talking about minutes, when we're talking about role, whether he's starting, whether he's coming off the bench, to me, the biggest thing is, and I do think he'll come off the bench, and I do think he'll be on a minutes restriction, it's can he help keep the Lakers afloat in the non-LeBron minutes, giving them another player that can get downhill, because that's where I've seen a lot of frustration on the offensive side of the ball from the Lakers. When LeBron's off the floor, even though he did have 8 turnovers last game, it seems like the offense is really ground to a halt at times. So what do you think Austin can bring, and can he be that piece that keeps things afloat while LeBron's off?
I think so. I agree with you. I think he will come off the bench. Not quite sure on the minutes restriction yet, but I would assume low to mid 20s, maybe somewhere in there to start. Where the minutes come from, I'm not quite sure. I think Bronny's been playing well, especially played well in Houston in the 2 games there. But I would assume that he takes the Bronny minutes, and then a little less Jake, who's been struggling offensively in the series. And then also the starters, again, I mentioned 3 of them had been playing 41 plus minutes going into game 4. I could see 3 or 4 of the non-DA starters having their minutes cut by just like a few minutes, and then you add that up to 22 to 26 minutes, something like that, for Austin. So I think it'll be like everybody plays, most of the perimeter guys play like a little bit less collectively, and that adds up to Austin's whatever he ends up playing. But I think that's my big thing here over the past 6 quarters has been LA has looked like they're without their 2 primary ball handlers. And I think that was where the concern had initially been when they lost Luka and Austin, was like, these have been the 2 lead ball handlers by far from just a usage perspective, but also bringing the ball up the floor, initiating the offense. And now they have to dramatically shift it to Marcus and Luke and LeBron. I think LeBron has done a great job as a number one option, but I still think even if you're going with that look, you still want someone bringing the ball up the floor and initiating it. So I think comparing Austin to Marcus as a primary ball handler is a pretty big gap there. And now we'll see what shape Austin is in. He's missed nearly a month, and it obviously was a leg injury. So I don't know if he's going to look 70%, 80%, 90%, like where he's going to be physically, not leg injury, but you know, conditioning injury, excuse me, with the rib and just, you know, kind of limited in your conditioning. So I think he'll need a little bit of time to get his legs back and his wind back under him. But I mean, the Lakers, I think, could use, if he just does what he's capable of doing in a 20-minute burst and it's 3 or 4 shifts, I think that would be very useful for this team. Like they were just running out of offensive options in that game 4, right? Like everyone was running on fumes. LeBron was dead tired at the end of game 3. It took everything from him to summon that, to conjure that, to get that win. He was gassed in game 4. Marcus looked gassed in game 4. I think a couple days off will help those guys, but the Lakers are running on fumes here. Like JJ's once again kind of leaned into, we're playing the starters very heavy minutes. I don't really trust the bench fully. He trusts them more than last year, but still not a lot. Most of the bench, it's been like 3 dudes between 15 to 18 minutes pretty much every night. And so adding another guy who can play into the 20s and, you know, eventually ramp up, I think that's going to do wonders for just everyone's legs, everyone's freshness. And if they somehow lose game 5 and it goes to a game 6, then I think hopefully some of the guys can have a little bit more juice and energy going into that game 6. So I think Austin's going to help a lot. It does give Houston another entry point into the defense, and another, like, that was another thing I you know, a couple things that I thought of while you guys were talking in terms of like adjustments were, one, they really targeted Luke Kennard in game four. Mm-hmm. They did a much more concerted effort, which again, I don't know why it took them so long to do this. And then the other thing was they put Reed Sheppard on Rui and just said, we dare you to run the offense through Rui, try to get Rui to score against Reed Sheppard. And he held up for the most part. So I think those are some of the other things that Houston's going to test with their, like they'll go at Austin. I think they went at Austin in the regular season, and that's something that the Lakers are going to have to prepare for.
You know, I'm seeing, as noted in the chat, and I have the concern as well, Austin has not been particularly good against Houston this year. He has had games, a series where he's been good in terms of the aggressive, athletic, physical, defensive play, particularly when we look at what he's done against Minnesota on the season. He's averaging 28 points per game against Minnesota, but against Houston, just 13.7 points per game, not shooting particularly well. Now, it's a small sample size of just three games, so, you know, take it for...
He did leave the Christmas game, he left at halftime, so right. I think those numbers are skewed a little bit.
And he played well in the first half of that game.
Exactly. He's not shooting well. 40% from the field, 19% from the three. But again,
didn't play that well in the two games in Houston.
It's worth mentioning about two and a half games. At least mentioning that historically he hasn't been great in his first few games back after a big absence.
Sure.
Again, like, I really don't think it matters as much when you're looking at, it's different coming back in with a Luka LeBron group where it's like, oh, these usage reps aren't really working for us. Let's give it back to LeBron and Luka. And like, we need somebody that can handle the basketball. Please, Austin, do it. Like, I think there's like a lower bar that he needs to hit to be a positive impact in a game like this.
He just needs his ability to
knock down a catch and shoot three.
He basically just needs to be better than Bronny and Jake offensively.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to do that.
One tiny note too. I would potentially consider playing Bronny anyway, maybe over a guy like Jake. The one thing with Bronny that I think has been super important that I think stood out more in game four even than game three is he's fast as shit, man. And like when he hits the gaps attacking closeouts in this matchup, he looks like one of the more comfortable Lakers in the rotation, and he's making really good reads there. And he has generated a lot of quality shots in this series driving closeouts. So, like, I'm not saying, you know, play him 20 minutes or anything, but, like, I wouldn't hate the idea of putting him in over a guy maybe like Jake if Jake has a rough first shift, and, like, maybe giving him a second half shift or something like that. Like, I wouldn't necessarily bail entirely on Bronny specifically because of how well he's played in this particular matchup.
How much do you weigh – in a situation like that, because I've had those thoughts about, Austin comes back, does he take most of Jake's minutes? Did Bronny's minutes? Now, against a team like the Rockets that rebounds so well, Jake's got some utility there. So how do you weigh that, knowing that Bronny is playing better, but Jake, in terms of size, you may need that on the wing?
It's tough.
I mean, it's also tough. We just don't know how many, like, you know, if it's 18 minutes for Austin, that's an easier problem to solve. If it's 26, that's a tougher problem to solve. Mm-hmm. I do think Marcus and Luke both could play a little bit less just in terms of keeping them fresh. And I feel like they both have worn down, and maybe there's obviously some variance and role players shoot better and play better at home in the playoffs compared to the road. But, you know, Luke especially, I think had a couple of rough games in Houston. But I think if you get Luke playing 34, 35 minutes instead of 40, 41, even that 5 to 6 minute difference can keep him fresher and preserve his legs for the rest of the series. And so that, you know, that's 6 minutes that goes to Austin. You find a few from Marcus, you're already at 10, halfway there. Rui plays a little bit less. LeBron maybe plays a minute or two less. You can buy him a little bit more time to be fresher in the fourth quarter. And then, you know, a few minutes from Jake and Bronny, and you get to the 18-20. Like, I think it's doable, but it is going to be interesting to see how JJ navigates that.
It's worth mentioning, too, that his injury is not like a calf injury or hamstring injury where you'd be worried about his minutes load leading to something that's a setback. So, like, let's say they go into the game and it's an 18-minute restriction, but Austin looks good and is playing well. I think they'll just pump up his minutes. You know, like, I don't think his injury is particularly... Like, I think his injury, the re-injury risk, has more to do with contact than it does with, like, playing time, if that makes sense.
Which, like, I mean, if I'm Houston, like, that's on... I don't know. I just wonder if Austin drives into the paint, you're probably there trying to hammer him.
Yeah. That's what Sengun already said today.
Let's put him in a flak jacket, guys.
The last thing I want to add on Austin, then we need to get into our chat questions and comments for the remainder of the show, is that I view him as, you know, people say, well, you know, you've got Amen Thompson that's going to just neutralize Austin Reeves. But that means those are minutes that Amen Thompson is not on Luke Kennard, that Amen Thompson is not defending Marcus Smart. I look at what Smart and Kennard have done over the course of this series. It's been Herculean. They've been phenomenal. But we did see, it's like they're bench pressing, right? And game four, their arms are getting shaky. Austin's going to come in and he's going to be that spotter. He's going to take some of that weight off of them. And I think this is where we see, even if Austin himself is not great in the game, if the Rockets have to redirect some of their defense to him, that's going to then take some of that burden off of Smart, off of Kennard, and allow them to get back to, I think, performing the way they did in games one through three. So that's what I think will be a big benefit here from the Lakers. It's not just about what Austin can do himself. It's about some of the pressure that he can take off of some of these other guys that the Rockets are really now starting to pick at.
Good point.
All right.
Agreed.
Let's get to our chat questions and comments in just one moment. First, we need to give a shout out to our final sponsor, and that is Cozy Earth.
All right, guys, before we keep going, quick shout out to Cozy Earth for sponsoring today's show. And I'll be real, this one actually fits perfectly with what we do because we're on here grinding, talking hoops, reacting to games. But when you finally get that downtime, you want to be comfortable. That's where Cozy Earth comes in. They've got robes and slippers that are built for these quiet moments, like after a long day or just kicking back watching a game like this. And with Mother's Day coming up, it's actually a really good gift idea. Because it's not just like a random gift. It's something she's actually going to use every day. The robes are super soft. They've got different styles. And the slippers are built to be worn all day, not just around the house for 5 minutes. It's just one of those things that feels premium right away. And the best part, you can try it risk-free. They've got a 100-night trial and a 10-year warranty. So you're not really taking a risk here. So if you're looking for something thoughtful for Mother's Day this year, go to CozyEarth.com. Use code HMA for 20% off. That's CozyEarth.com. And if there's a survey after checkout, just let them know you came from our show, because at the end of the day, home starts with mom.
All right. Big shout out to Cozy Earth. Appreciate you for sponsoring today's show. Guys, we're going to dedicate the remainder of the show to your questions, your comments, the super chats that are coming in. We're going to start with this one that came in before the show started. And this goes into a conversation we were having a little bit over text last night, guys. Is Jalen Duren a good fit? Sign and trade for him. Jason, I know you had some thoughts on Duren, what he's done with the Pistons so far in this series, what he's not done, and whether or not he's the guy the Lakers should go all in on, throw a max offer at, and then cross their fingers and hope that the Pistons don't match.
So I texted you guys immediately when this was getting thrown out last night, and I was like, this would be the quickest way to ruin the Luka Doncic era. And it comes down to like a combination of two factors. One is Jadern as a player, and then two is how you kind of use your cap. So the Dern as a player piece of this, I do think that he would have a lot of utility with Luka offensively that is important to acknowledge here. Like, one, he is a very good screener. And so Luka would be getting downhill pretty easily whenever he needs to against teams that run drop coverage. And he rolls well. He's a great catch and finish guy around the basket, good vertical spacer, all that kind of stuff. Good offensive rebounder. The offensive utility kind of ends there when it comes to certain types of matchups. Like, yes, he did have a year where he could face up and he could hit a little pull-up jump shot. He could rack to the right and get all the way to the basket and post up a little bit. But like, that was very matchup dependent. And you're seeing that against Wendell Carter Jr. He cannot score against Wendell Carter Jr. because he cannot bully Wendell Carter Jr. It's also affecting his usefulness on the offensive glass, right? So on that end, like, what did I just describe? I basically just described Jackson Hayes with better screening in terms of like what you're getting offensively against certain types of matchups. I'm underselling it a little bit because obviously he can offensive rebound better, and that screening piece is very, very important. But the point is that's you're not getting that much more out of that side of the floor. And then on defense, this is the second year in a row where he's kind of been exposed in a lot of ways. And he's struggled to guard in pick and roll in this series, defending both the guy getting downhill and the lob threat. Last year against Karl Anthony Towns, he was a mess trying to guard out on the perimeter in space. And so then it kind of comes to the cap space side of it, which is like, if I felt like I was getting a dude who was an elite rim protector, an elite defensive rebounder, a guy who had some switching versatility on defense, a guy who could screen and roll at a really high level, who was also a great offensive rebounder, who could also beat a switch by me throwing the ball into the post and all that kind of stuff. Okay, now, if we're talking $35, $40 million, that makes a lot of sense to me. But that's just not what Jalen Duren is. And so my thing is like, if they could have got Zubats, then sure, you could tie up a good amount of cap for a player like that. But like anything below that tier, I just would rather have a discounted player. I'd rather try to find the next DeAndre Ayton type of dude who's looking for a way to rehab his value around the league. I'd rather look for guys that are, you know, like Nemes Keita in Boston, who are like a pro scouting wins, where you find a team that's undervaluing a player that can fit with Luka that doesn't fit with them. Like, I just would be really careful about that center position with tying up a ton of money. The most I'd be willing to spend on just like a regular ass screen and roll dude is kind of like what Nick Claxton is. And even then, I don't want to do it if it's going to cost a lot of draft compensation. I just think it's a very delicate balance with that center position, because if you have a smart front office, you can get high quality center play. I'd even argue Ayton and Jackson have done a pretty good job since March. Like, not perfect, far from perfect, but considering the total investment in between those two guys is what, $11 million? Am I right about that? Right around there. Considering the total salary investment, you're getting a lot of production out of those two guys, and like, you better be like certain that it is a massive upgrade if you're going to either spend a lot more salary or spend a lot in the form of assets to trade for a player like that. And I just don't think Duren's that guy.
Yeah, realistically, you're talking about almost quadrupling the amount of money that you're spending to get Duren as compared to, assuming that it would be a max salary situation in order to get Detroit to even consider blinking there, compared to what you're paying. Would you rather, if you're going to give up that, let's call it the fund max, the 25% max, the $41.5 million starting salary, it would go up from there, obviously. Would you rather give that money, if you had to give that money to one of the two guys, Duren or Kessler, would you rather go Kessler? I think I'd probably lean Kessler. And the only hesitation is he didn't play much this season. Yeah.
Because he can anchor the defense. That's the key.
And even the rebounding, I would say, too.
What'd you say, Yovan?
The rebounding.
Yeah.
I think he's a better rebounder.
So I think the opportunity cost for going after a player like that, because essentially for the Lakers, that would mean there's not really any money left over to address the wing position. It probably means goodbye LeBron at that point. If you were to throw the max at Duren, plus logistically, we think about what the RFA situation would be with restricted free agency, sitting out there in limbo while you wait for the moratorium to lift. Like, there's that hurdle that you'd have to clear as well, unless this would, you know, be something that would come together later in free agency. You miss out on a few players and then you go a different direction there. But I'd be careful. I know he's a big name and I know there's some excitement around that. Hey, you can add a center to the mix, but I don't know that spending that much money on the center position is the right move. It's not quite the same, but there are some ways where it reminds me a little bit of the running back position in the NFL, where you don't necessarily want to be the team that's spending the bulk of your cap space on the position, unless you're getting a truly next level game changing type five. So that's I'd be very cautious going after Jalen Duren. All right. Tyler said, send Shampoo and Durkant home. Well, I always love a good pun there. Lakers in five. That's the plan. That's the goal. We'll see if they can pull that off. Let's go here. How many minutes will Austin Reaves get if he plays on Wednesday? What are we expecting to see there?
I'm going
to
guess 25.
Yeah, I'll go 24. Maybe a little bit more conservative. I'm trying to see here, because the last two times he's come back from injury, he's come off the bench and he played 21, almost 22 in Phoenix right before Christmas. And then coming back off the extended absence, he played 21 in Brooklyn, but that was also a game that the Lakers blew them out. Then he played 25, 24, 29. So yeah, I'll say somewhere in that like 24 to 26 range.
Yeah. What do you think? Oh, this is a question about tanking. Do you think the PWHL's take on preventing tanking would work for the NBA, being once a team is mathematically out for the playoffs, then they start earning points towards draft odds for each win? It's an interesting idea. Here's the problem that I run into, guys, and you tell me if you guys feel the same way, but every time something comes up, the immediate thought in my head is, well, teams are just going to do this then. You know, like there's always
going to be tank you at the beginning of the season here, right? Like it's
exactly,
it just it almost inverses the problem, because like usually the first 2 to 3 months of the season are pretty competitive, where everyone's like, maybe a team suffers like a major injury early in the season, then they kind of sneakily start to tank. But first couple months, you know, some random results, some variants, and teams are going for it. And then they start, you know, Utah has been famous for this the last few years, where Utah has like a decent start to the season, and then they progressively start resting guys in fourth quarters. I guess there's always an unintended consequence. I do think it's interesting, though, and some sort of system that does incentivize winning later in the season, I think would be beneficial, because it does feel like the last two or three seasons, the standings have almost come down to like who, especially in the middle of the West. The middle of the West is always jumbled, like 3-6, 3-7, 3-8, whatever. It always kind of comes down to like which team has the easiest schedule here in terms of just has the most tanking teams on the remaining schedule, and that team gets a little bit of a boost down the stretch. So I would like to see it flipped. My general thing that I feel like I still just don't understand with the whole tanking situation is like the bad teams are still bad. Like Brooklyn was not going to win 40 games if Brooklyn went for it. Brooklyn had an objectively terrible roster. So it's like, I also think that the like added component of, you don't necessarily need to rest your guys in the second half or fourth quarter. Like you're probably going to lose anyway. I just don't get that, you know, part of it, but yeah, I think the unintended consequence here would be some teams would start the season off tanking rather than closing it tanking.
If you have a player that's injured to start the season, especially a star level player, you could rack up a bunch of losses. Then you're mathematically eliminated. Then suddenly your guys come back and then you go on a run from there. And next thing you know, you're drafting the next Wemby or whatever. That's the challenge. There's, again, there will always be unintended consequences. And that's a great call out by you, Jovan. And that's why I've been stressing whatever the NBA does this summer. And obviously they're going to do something. Adam Silver has made it clear. He's pissed about tanking. That's fine. Don't overcorrect. I'm terrified that they're going to overdo it and they're going to create other problems that that they're then going to have to address in a few years. And I think that's what's coming, honestly. There are always unintended consequences to things, and that could very well be where this goes, again, if they go too far with however they address tanking. Let's go here. How concerned are we that Austin Reaves will be rusty and turnover prone? I keep thinking about that fateful game against OKC.
We can't hit shots or take care of the basketball now. Yeah, so like if Austin comes in and does that, it'll just be more of the same. If he comes, I like I said, I think the bar for him to be an addition is pretty low.
Yeah, it's not so much that he's got to be the best player. He's just got to be better than the other options that are out there right now and take some of the pressure off.
I also think like he struggled beyond OKC, right? Like I think one of the San Antonio games, a couple of the Houston games, there's been, you know, Phoenix, there's been matchups where he has struggled, but OKC is, someone asked me about this, the other day on my show, and was comparing sort of like the OKC and Houston defenses. And the analogy I made was going from Houston to OKC in terms of handling their defense and their ball pressure is like going from a White Claw to a Four Loko. It is a pretty big gap there, but between one of them, you're going to feel a little bit of a buzz. One of them, you're going to be blacked out. So that's the difference in OKC's ball pressure and their defense compared to Houston. So I do think for Houston, like if he was getting thrown into OKC, I would be a bit concerned based on the 1 month absence, but I think he'll be okay against Houston.
Can I add one other thing too? Like, You know who's leading the Lakers in minutes in the playoffs?
Is it Rui?
It's Luke Kennard.
Oh, man.
And, like, Luke has been pretty bad the last two games. And I think part of it is he looks exhausted. And the big thing I've noticed is, like, even some of his more open looks from three have not looked like the typical Luke Kennard, like, really, you know, quality set shot. So, like, I think the easy guy for Austin to be better than right now is Luke, in the sense that, like, if you could just cut Luke's minutes down a little bit, it'll allow Luke to be more explosive when he's on the floor and less tired. And it won't be hard for Austin to be better than Luke has been in the last couple of games.
Yeah.
It's very possible that most of the minutes Austin eats up come from that department.
And that, and again, that could definitely have a positive impact on the Lakers if you're able to eat up some of the tired Kennard minutes. He's done a phenomenal job stepping into the role that he's stepped into, better than I think anybody would have predicted, with the ball handling responsibilities, running the offense, the things that he's done there. He's shown a knack and a feel for the game that I don't think we fully expected him to have when he came to the Lakers, in terms of being able to be an actual primary ball handler at times. But still, it's not the ideal role for him long term. And having Austin allows him to, I think, to slot into more of his ideal role, which can be as a more of a secondary ball handler than a primary ball handler. Maybe you lean in a little bit more to Luke Kennard in a ball handling role now that we've seen what we've seen. But it's also asking a lot for him to do it night in, night out as one of the main guys that's going to be asked to bring the ball up, initiate the offense, do it's all that sort
40
of stuff.
Minutes per game. He, in his career, has never had a season where he's averaged over 33 minutes per game. His previous playoff stints, 20 minutes per game in Memphis, 21 in Memphis, 15 with the Clippers, 33 back in 2019, literally 7 years ago with the Detroit Pistons. Like, this is an unprecedented workload for Luke Kennard.
I thought it was that was a good little reference there with the Four Loko thing. Brought back some some very hazy memories there, Jovan.
Thanks, Jovan. I think I only had a Four Loko once, and I'm certain that I was violently ill that night. So
you're just drinking gasoline. Anyway, we won't go
I'm
down.
Sorry
that
for getting us off the rails here.
DA was balling before the ejection. Austin Reeves helps him out big time. Yeah, I thought DA was maybe the only Laker having an above average game in game four was DeAndre Ayton. Mm-hmm. And then he got erroneously ejected from the game. And that officiating crew did a horrendous job. They messed up the Suns game. I pray that officiating crew does not get a game that's actually close where they can impact the outcome, because clearly they have lost touch. They don't know what to call, what moment, what is an ejection, what isn't. I feel for Adu Thiro as well. No reason. Even worse was the Adu Thiro situation. But as far as Ayton, yeah, he did have a going. I hope we see that version of DeAndre Ayton in game five here as well. Kind of felt like you're wasting a pretty good outing out of DeAndre Ayton, that it happened to occur in game four, which was a blowout loss, and nobody else around him really got going.
I mean, even Şengün criticized the ejection. Şengün called it soft, which I don't know if that was the right thing tactically to do. You got the benefit of that call. But I mean, yeah, even the opponent saying it was a soft ejection.
Marcus Smart got a $35,000 fine for questioning the integrity of the officials. Luke Kennard got a $25,000 fine for telling the referee he effing sucks. Only he didn't say effing, of course. Do you think that's going to have any impact on game five, now that the Lakers have pretty much made their feelings clear about the way the officiating went, does that have any impact on what we see and how the game gets officiated in game five?
I'm generally of the belief that the team that plays with more force gets the better whistle. It's always been that way, which kind of seems counterintuitive, but it's just always the way it goes. And I think that if the Lakers come out and play with more as the more forceful team in game five, I think they're going to get a better whistle. Like, it just is, when you're reacting to everything rather than initiating everything, you tend to get the worst whistle. It just is kind of how it goes.
Yep. Agree. That tends to be the way that it goes. I thought it was interesting that Alper and Sengun was already made comments about, you know, they're hitting us back. The difference is when the Lakers hit Sengun back, he just hurls himself to the ground. As opposed to when he's hitting the Lakers, it's he's throwing that giant arm out there and bowling through people. So I'm curious to see how he especially gets officiated. We'll do this last one here. The Real Biller said, Jovan, I happened to meet you at the Lakers-Clippers game. Super nice dude. Listen to you guys separately before. Love the Lakers Voltron now. I love the Voltron. I like that. Reference.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Nice to meet you. It's been great. Like I texted you guys this a few weeks ago, but I'll be walking around the arena and get stopped by someone who listens to my show or listens to this show. And it has increasingly been this show that people listen to and reference and say they love. So it really means a lot when you guys stop us and let us know how much you enjoy this show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We appreciate all of you. Hopefully we'll get to see some of you in Vegas at Summer League as well. We've got that coming up in a few months. So that's going to be exciting. But thank you again, everybody, for joining today's show. Tomorrow, we've got game 5. We'll see if the Lakers can end the series and move on here to face the Oklahoma City Thunder in round 2. Guys, great show. As always, one of the highlights of the week. And I can't wait till Thursday till we get to break down what happened in game 5.
Let's hope we're celebrating a win, boys. It's good to see you guys. Looking forward to Thursday.
Yes, sir.
Let's go. Let's go. All right, everybody. Thanks again. Till next time. See ya. And stay safe.